KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I mean, maybe once in a while I try to be funnier because I'm like, what am I talking about? And so I'll make a little joke out of my own insecurity.
I don't think that these 10 years will be seen as having achieved all that much for China.
I do store chips. If I chip up branches or things like that, which are great to have on hand.
We're going to garden today and talk about things you might store for later. That was Greg Rayburn. We're also going to hear from Greg Fitzsimmons, who's an Emmy Award winner. He's focusing on podcasting as a way to get his comedies out. Well, he's going to talk to Katie Sewell. And you also heard a China scholar talking about what Hu Jintao's reign has been like and what we could expect next. For that, we turn to David Bachman, who's a professor at the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies, joining us again to talk about China. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
On November 8th, Chinese Communist Party's 18th Party Congress convenes. Is that a meaningful? Will there be meaningful decisions made at that Party Congress?
They set the stage. It's roughly like an American political convention. What will be really important will be the Central Committee meeting immediately after that, which will probably be a week later. And there the official rollout of the new leadership will take place.
Now, why is the old leadership going away? Is 10 years the term limit for leaders?
Effectively now it is, so that Hu Jintao has served his two terms, Wen Jiabao and a number of the other leaders. There's also a norm of retiring somewhere around 70, so that a number of the people on the Politburo Standing Committee, right now the top nine people in China, a number of them will have to step down. All of this opens up a lot of space for new people to be appointed. Not so new, but different.
Well, so how about that? Is there a new wave of younger people coming in to leadership in China?
Well, there will be two younger leaders in particular, one of whom, Xi Jinping, will be the general secretary of the party. The other, Li Keqiang, will be probably the prime minister or premier. But the other names being mooted about these days for the Politburo Standing Committee, in fact, will be older than those two, will be in their mid to late 60s, and are seen generally as much more conservative in some ways than other leaders are. And some younger, more reformist type of leaders are seen as not making the cut this time around.
So does that tell you something about what China's the Politburo's intentions are going forward?
I think we're making much too much about this, this has been a very remarkable year in Chinese politics in terms of revelations and things coming out. But for the most part, with one or two exceptions, these people who are candidates for the top seven or nine positions are generally seen as representing interests as opposed to being powerful individual leaders. We don't know how they interact with each other, what sort of intergroup dynamics they would have. They have been competent administrators, or so it appears. But the people who've had fairly substantial records of success or breakthroughs seem to have not made the cut this time around. Hmm. And that seems to suggest people who work within the system, who are products of the system, are much more likely to thrive than are those who may be somewhat more explicit about campaigning for the top spots.
They like people to be self-effacing.
Yeah, to not put much of their own self out there, to be loyal members of the party, loyal leaders of the party, can-do types, but not distinctive.
Well, what did you mean when this has been a year of some revelations? What are you speaking to?
Well, I'm speaking about the purge and the arrest of Bo Xilai and Chongqing, the revelations now that have come out over this year about the personal wealth of many Chinese leaders. Bo first, New York Times had that. Then we had the personal wealth of Xi Jinping from the Bloomberg News Service.
Now, was he the one whose family has benefited?
No,
that was
Wen Jiabao.
That was Wen Jiabao.
Came out a week ago or so from the New York Times. And it appears that every member of the Politburo, the top 25 or so, seems to have a personal fortune of at least $100 million, or his family does. So when we talk about a party that sees corruption as a major problem, has more than a few conflicts of interest.
I see. I'm shocked that there's gambling in this establishment, huh? So Xi Jinping, where's his wealth from?
Their family has property investments in China and even in England, and all sorts of other activities. And what's remarkable in some ways is not that this is coming out. I think many people or many insiders or China watchers had a suspicion that these people or their families were well off. But the fact that this information has been ferreted out by news agencies, I mean, The Times did a wonderful job on Wen Jiabao, but the fact that this information is coming out suggests more transparency in the system about things we never would have expected to come out than ever before.
The discussion in China, if it reforms, is about rule of law, that China has to be a nation with the rule of law. Are these revelations telling us something about that, or is that a different idea?
I think that when we hear the Chinese talk about rule of law or they talk about democracy, as the party does, I think we have to keep in mind that they have their own particular meanings attached to these phrases. For rule of law, I think they want a well-regulated society, one where people do obey the law, that the law sets out parameters within which people can act, what defines what's legal and what's illegal. But we're not really talking, it seems to me, about due process. We're certainly not talking about the people through their representatives making the law in the way that we think rule of law means, oh, the law is unjust, then we'll have to pass a law to change it and make it better. None of that element is about it. There are elements such as family law, divorce law, where I think you do have elements of the rule of law in China. But when it comes to corporate conduct, when it comes to political crimes, there I think we're a very, very long way from rule of law.
David Bachman studies China as a professor at the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies. So where is China's economy today? It's contracted. And how is that going to affect the movement of these leaders as they assume power?
Well, this is the big question right now, it seems to me, that that the economy is slowing, although at least officially it's growing at 7.5% as opposed to 10%. But the signs are it's going to continue to slow. Their economy has been based on a model or a growth model predicated on very high levels of domestic investment and exports. Their export partners, U.S. is recovering, Europe is not, Japan is slowing, that its major markets for exports are going to have slow to minimal growth. So exports aren't going to be a spur to invest to growth for China. Investment, there's already so much investment that it's hard to see that this will have a good long-term payoff. There have been discussions even by the Hu Jintao leadership as many as 6 or more years ago suggesting that there should be a move to a more consumption-oriented economy where China's own consumers would provide the sort of demand for growth. And yet there's been very little progress on that. And if the new leadership is a product of the vested interests who have benefited from high investment and exports, getting them to shift away from the advantages to those sectors and move them to more infrastructure investment in schools and education, healthcare, freeing up money in banks so that people can buy things, that's going to run against their direct interests.
Yeah, so these revelations in some way are revelatory about what has kept China's economy from focusing on those issues.
To an extent. I don't mean to imply that there hasn't been broad gains for incomes in China, that lots of growth has taken place, lots of people have benefited. Inequality has gotten much worse, to be sure. But for the most part, at least until very recently, there's tended to be a rising tide lifting at least many, if not all, boats. But how long that can be sustained, and I think there's a consensus among all knowledgeable economists that this is an unsustainable growth model, and what happens when the crunch comes is what's going on. But as you say, the people in the system are highly protective of that. Their in-laws are highly protective of that.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times article was quite interesting about how all this, what was it, his mother-in-law or his?
Or his mother.
Or his mother, that's right. In this little village is quite wealthy with,
yes,
with all sorts of holdings. And right, you were saying, well, how did she get all those holdings in her name?
Yeah.
This little in from a little village.
Yeah.
Well, so I was watching and one of those interminable ads popped up. And you say this ad had been from 2010 as well. It was a very it was an auditorium of Chinese students, most of them in black, and a man on stage, Chinese man on stage with a – he looked like Steve Jobs, I realize now. He sort of had that Steve Jobs kind of very high-tech look, and he was doing all these amazing things with photos behind him. And he was saying, you know, well, this is when the U.S. – how empires decline. They go into debt, and the U.S. went into debt. This is – oh, that's right. It says it took place in 2030. And the U.S. was in debt, and, of course, we held all their debt, and everybody laughs. How do the Chinese leadership or the Chinese economic community, how do they view that fact of holding American debt? Because we, I mean, that ad is implying we should be very afraid.
That's what the ad's implying.
Yeah.
I don't think we should be very afraid at all. It's their problem as much as it is ours. Perhaps even bigger for them. They have pegged their currency more or less to the U.S. dollar. That if they tried to get rid of their currency holdings, tried to do damage to us, if they tried to dump them on secondary treasury markets, they'd take a huge loss. It would anger the U.S. government. There would be retaliation. We'd get into the equivalent of financial nuclear war. There would be barriers on Chinese exports. We'd both be worse off, but China would be, I would argue, more worse off than we would be.
And yet, of the few foreign policy debates we had in this campaign, it was who's tougher on Chinese tariffs and product dumping?
Well,
all for the domestic market?
I think a lot of it is scapegoating, that to be sure there are Chinese trade abuses. There are many ways where Americans have legitimate gripes against the Chinese. But on some of these things, there's a lot of hot air and not a lot of substance. You know, the trade deficit issue, the subsidy, the currency manipulation charge. Most people now say that with inflation, China's currency is not grossly undervalued at this time. You look at what they're selling, and it turns out that, you know, for laptops or iPhones that are sent to the U.S., the Chinese contribution in terms of actual price is about 5%. And yet the way we do trade statistics, all of the value of your, you know, at least the list of the at-cost price of your iPhone 5 is about $240. All that gets charged to China when China's contribution is about $5.
Hmm.
So the trade deficit is overstated. The currency is moving into alignment. There is lots of espionage, industrial theft, lots of preferences and subsidies for Chinese products, to be sure. But it's not nearly as bad as it was portrayed in the campaign by both sides.
Yeah. David Bachman's our guest. Well, you know, you mentioned the Times. The Times had this article about Xi Jinping when he takes power. He will be assuming supreme power in China at a time when relations between the two countries are adrift, sullied by suspicions over a clash of interests in Asia and by frequent attacks on China in the American presidential campaign. Do our relationships seem adrift to you, our relations?
I think, you know, some of it may be heated because of the elections. I think there right now is good communications between the Obama administration and China. Not to say that the Obama administration is getting what it wants done, but I think there's understanding. Obviously, the Chinese would have some uncertainty about a Romney administration, partly because it was new, partly because of his promise on his first day in office to brand them a currency manipulator. I think that there are tensions in the relationship, to be sure. I think part of those tensions come not from the nature of the relationship itself, but as China feels itself becoming the number two power in the system, is more assertive about that, and I would argue has frankly been counterproductive to obtaining many of its long-term ends by taking on these quite hardline policies about the Diaoyu Islands and the South China Sea Islands, and being more confrontational than it probably wants to be, and yet that's being that's sort of setting off alarm bells in Tokyo and Taipei and countries in Southeast Asia as well, all of which only strengthen the U.S. position in Asia, which is exactly what China doesn't want to have happen.
So last quick question. They say that Mr. Xi's relations to the military are part of this issue because he's got close relations. What do you think?
Certainly his career path, his family history suggests he does. But I think one of our problems with China is it really is a collective leadership. That quote you gave me a minute ago from the Times about as the supreme leader, well, he'll be the first among equals, I assume, much more than a supreme leader. His will not be what happens. There will be an attempt to build consensus within the leadership. It looks like Xi does have better contacts with the military than Hu Jintao did. But does that mean he controls them or is he their servant? I mean, you get into all these things that, you know, this is where Donald Rumsfeld did give us a break in terms of the known unknowns. We don't know what the real relationships are. We don't know how the sort of operative handling of politics takes place in behind closed doors in Beijing. And we can speculate, and there's a whole business of speculation in Hong Kong and in the United States and most intelligence agencies. And on what is any of this based? Who knows?
All right. Well, we will get the knowns and the unknowns and unknown unknowns and known unknowns from David Bachman in the months ahead. He's a professor at the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies. On November 8th, the Chinese Communist Party's 18th Party Congress convenes. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It's weekday.
It's 1021 KUOW 94.9, news and information.
KUOW and Green Stage present their hard-barred show, Cardenio. A usurping tyrant's cold-blooded scheme to attain love is chilled when the lady he craves makes a grave attempt to escape his desires. November 2nd through the 17th at the Center Theater at Seattle Center. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the state of Montana, with 15 ski areas with short lift lines and millions of acres of untracked powder between Glacier and Yellowstone National Parks. Winter vacation planning tools at wintermt.com.
51 degrees in Seattle. We've got some areas of fog, which will burn off. We'll get a high around 58 with rain expected today. Tonight, a low around 46, mostly cloudy, showers likely mainly before 10 tonight, and on Wednesday, a little bit cooler, a high near 52, partly sunny skies in Seattle.
Greg Fitzsimmons is an Emmy Award-winning writer, stand-up comedian. He's also host of a popular podcast called FitzDog Radio. Fitzsimmons was in town this past weekend performing at the Moore Theater. Weekday producer Katie Sewell caught up with him before his stand-up show to talk about how he arranges and creates and distributes his podcast.
It's called FitzDog Radio, which, you know, I don't love the title, but that's what it is. And it became an extension of a show I do on the Howard Stern channel on Sirius, where I bring in guests, writers, comedians, actors, and just talk kind of free form. And then I would do it for an hour on that, and then it would end, and I would always feel like, that's it. You know, they would want to talk more and I would. So we just started recording a separate track and putting it out as a podcast. It's probably 3.5 years ago. And then people liked it and they kind of wanted more. So I started doing a second podcast. And so now it's one of these podcasts that people count on. You know, I have people come to my shows and they're like, oh, my God, you get me through my work week. And it's really kind of cool. It's a very committed thing. I mean, as opposed to, well, NPR is different. I think as opposed to like your regular terrestrial radio with ads, and it's kind of on in the background and you may or may not be listening, but podcasts, and I think NPR are much more, committed listener. They're listening to every word and it has much more of an effect on them. It's a kind of a responsibility. I didn't mean it as a responsibility, but now I feel like I got to keep the quality up on every episode, and I feel like I have to be honest on them because I think that's what people kind of count on. It's a very personal narrative that you're giving, and one episode kind of leads into the next, and they kind of like your life. And so you got to rip back the layers and, you know, let it out.
Well, how fast did it grow? Like, well, as you were watching it develop over the 3.5 years?
Well, I came out of the gate strong because of the Stern audience. They immediately came on, so I had decent numbers. And then I would start to do other people's podcasts, like Adam Carolla has a huge one, and I would see I saw a big jump when I started doing his. And then Joe Rogan, who I'm in town doing a show with, I do his. So it's almost like it's very hard to go out and you couldn't do the Today Show or Letterman and say, check out my podcast, because people would go, what's a podcast? And what do I got to download? I got to push buttons. But if you can go to people that already have podcast listeners and they're predisposed to knowing the process, then you can really, get a lot more. And then it's just a matter of doing them again and again and again until people tell their friends about it.
Speaking with Greg Fitzsimmons, Fitzog Radio, his podcast. So you're talking in a microphone, often in a hotel room, sometimes alone, sometimes with somebody else as you're on the road. Do you imagine all these thousands of people listening while you're doing it, or do you feel like it's you and your guest?
Well, right now I just feel like it's me and you talking. That's how it always feels. You know, you just, hopefully you're listening to what the person's saying. And I think as a comedian, there's a lot of pressure to think about how the audience is reacting. And I think what I liked about the podcast, it almost feels like writing. You're just, whatever's in your head, you're putting it out. And when you interview somebody or get interviewed, I think it's just, if it's going well, it's just a conversation. I always have talking points that I can fall back on. But if things go well, I never look at my notes and it just becomes something. I think if I thought about who was listening and how they were perceiving it, I would probably change my tack. I mean, maybe once in a while I try to be funnier, because I'm like, what am I talking about? And so I'll make a little joke out of my own insecurity. And that probably is the thing people like the most about the podcast.
The nature of a podcast is if you're just doing this narrative about your life and yourself and the comedians you're talking to, people know a lot more about you now.
Too much. Yeah. You know, people come to my shows and they'll be like, hey, Greg, how's your hemorrhoid? And I'll be like, how do you know about, God, did I talk about my hemorrhoid? And so it's sort of like, I can't keep track of all the hours I talk. I'm just filling up space sometimes. It's like it's a one-sided relationship, because then they'll come to a show or see me on the street and they'll start talking to me like they really know me. Like I always say, like when you see somebody who's a movie star, you don't really approach them because they're bigger than life. They're physically bigger than you when you watch them. TV stars, like you're excited. You might go up and get an autograph, but podcasts, they'll come up and put their arm around you and start arguing the other half of something you said, and you're already friends. And that might be closer than I want to be to most people. I don't like people as individuals that much. I like people as a group. Strangers coming up to me is very uncomfortable.
Why do you think comedians are kind of running the podcast market at the moment? There's just so many comedians doing podcasts right now.
I guess there's commercial reasons, and then I think there's also style reasons. I think stylistically we're used to speaking for, you know, extended periods of time, and I think we know how to punctuate, and we know we have a kind of barometer for when things are getting boring. Like I was just saying, you make a joke, and if I'm interviewing somebody and I know and I'm not feeling like it's good, then I'll cut them off or I'll be rude or I'll say something aggressive and then they have to wake up. I kind of shake them out of it. So I think that for somebody who's not used to being on stage and having to live or die by the crowd's reaction, you wouldn't have that internal sort of scripting ability. And then I think commercially, it's something that really translates to people coming out to see your shows. A comedian is essentially, I hate that I'm about to say this word, but a brand. You know, now it's like you're a Twitter account, you're a Facebook account, you're a podcast, you're somebody who comes live to towns and performs, you're going on, you know, whatever TV shows you do. And so the podcast is just a great way to pull all that together.
So can you tell what your brand is by what you're purposely trying to make it, or is it more about the kind of people you're attracting?
That's a good question. Outstanding question. And I wish I had an answer, because I am without a brand, and I think it's my downfall. I've been doing this for so many years, And I believe I'm funny, and I believe I'm a good writer, and I think I'm a good interviewer. But I have never become like that big name, and I think it's because I wouldn't know how to describe me. You know, I'm just a white guy with a receding hairline, bordering on bald. What would you call it?
Receding, not bordering on bald.
I appreciate that. And so when people have to conjure me up, it's not like you think of Carrot Top, orange, carrot, top, one name, got it. And I think if I had called myself Mumbo Mouth, at one point somebody called up a comedy club in Boston and she says, who's on the show tonight? And they said, well, it's Jackie Flynn, Anthony Clark, and Greg Fitzsimmons. And the woman said, is Grapefruit Simmons the headliner? I forgot to mention she's from the 1930s. And I should have at that moment changed my name to Grapefruit Simmons. And I think that people would have always, like, people come in to see me in a given weekend, a couple thousand people come and go. And at this point, most of them are coming because they know me. But the ones that aren't going to remember my name. And for years, people didn't come to see me. I happened to be on the show, and they would come in and out, and they would take nothing with them. You know, the idea of branding is distasteful to me because you like to think of yourself as more of an artist. But it's naive to think that with all the comedians and podcasts and all that out there that you shouldn't try to be a little bit mature and grown up like it's a job.
Speaking with Greg Fitzsimmons, comedian and host of FitzDog Radio.
I love when you do that. It's so, it brings me into like the gentle, lights low world of NPR. Say it softer.
Speaking with Greg Fitzsimmons, podcaster, comedian, host of many things to come, I'm sure.
My IQ just went up like 8 points.
Well, you know, that's interesting what you said about the strength of a name. Because there's something about the political season where you're paying a lot of attention to people's names, you know. So is Greg Fitzsimmons just not a strong, memorable enough name?
I don't think so. People hear my name and they think it's Simmons and they, you know, and it's just I'm Irish. And I think that there's very keen racism towards the Irish. They think of us as thieves and miscreants, philanderers and drunks. That's not true. But I think it is important to have a sharp. You know, again, like branding isn't just a name. I think it's also about what do you talk about? And for me, it's like, well, I talk about politics sometimes. I talk about my personal life. I talk about things I might observe, talk about existential thoughts. And I'm all over the place. And if you want to really create a following, you got to be the guy that talks about food, the guy who gets angry about everyday stuff, or the girl who's kind of petite and sweet, but then she's got a foul mouth. You know, it's got to be that simple. You tell me, because you've seen me perform live. You've interviewed me. What's the Greg Fitzsimmons brand? What's the Grapefruit Simmons brand?
I think it's the very downplayed. It's both downplayed and upplayed. That's the hard part, I guess. The very downplayed, like, come on, people. You know I'm a really smart guy here. You know. That's your brand. The funny guy that's smarter than the rest of us.
Oh, I like that.
Does that work?
But with that brand then, that can be off-putting to people. If I'm sitting in an audience and I've worked all week at a, you know, factory job and now I'm just going to have a few beers and let it out, I don't want some preachy guy who went to college looking down on me. So how do you counteract that?
But I think you also are not above being like, oh, man, you know, I really blow.
Yeah, so I think.
You're riding that line of being like way smarter, but also making fun of yourself.
I think it's difficult to have a large ego and very low self-esteem. And I think that I've somehow struggled. That's my struggle in
life.
Maybe
that's your brand.
If I could, yeah, that's my brand, that I am smarter than you, yet intimidated by you. Oh, isn't that horrible?
Greg Fitzsimmons, big ego, low self-esteem.
It's the worst thing in the world because if I could just be in the middle, I mean, I am really unhappy. Like, I am not a happy person at all because I do feel like I should be more successful. And yet I look at what I've got and I think I don't deserve this. I really do. At any given moment, I swing one way or the other. And so if I was just an egomaniac, if I was like most stars, and I can tell you, this is from Hollywood direct. I've written on shows and produced them. I know a lot of celebrities. They're all narcissistic sociopaths who don't ever doubt that they should be popular, more powerful, richer than you. And I think that if you oscillate between that and even having normal feelings, you will not be competitive in Hollywood. So if there's some kind of hypnotism I can go in.
But wouldn't you like to be a more humble, down-to-earth person?
Of course. But for so many years, I've been driven by my fear of failure and this fake ego. It's not a real ego. It's like, you know, probably my need to get love from my mother and my need to whatever. I don't know where an ego always comes from. Maybe it's not that easy, but I have it. And I don't know that without it, I would get out of bed. I don't know what would drive me. So no, I can't be that person. I would be sublimating this burning, horrible, unhealthy thing in me, which I think you get to a certain point in your life and you start accepting your negative traits as well as your positive ones. And you realize that sometimes that's your fuel. So yeah, I want to control it. And I think I've done a pretty good job of controlling it and focusing it. But ultimately, I fail myself because I'm not more self-centered, which is hard to say in an interview where you're doing nothing but talking about yourself.
What does it feel like before a show? How soon are we? We have about, what, an hour and a half until you're on stage?
Yeah, hour and a half.
What's it like to in that hour and a half before a show? Say you weren't doing an NPR interview, but you were just here in your room.
Well, it would be this. It would be looking at pieces of paper like, can you read that? It's going through scraps of paper that are written down, napkins.
Hawaiian shirt, fun, attract fun.
Oh, yeah.
That's one thing it says.
If you wear a Hawaiian shirt, it means that you want to go out and have fun. I'm talking about how people identify themselves. That's been a theme I've been trying to get into is like that we all – it's like I think Kurt Vonnegut had a thing in one of his books called A Grand Falloon, which is when people try to call themselves a Hoosier to give themselves identity. They're part of a collective. And so just talking about in life how people, if you wear the Hawaiian shirt, you're sending out a message like, I'm having fun tonight. Or if you're a chick and you wear a low-cut dress and 8-inch heels, then, you know, you're going out not necessarily to have sex, but you're going out to feel your sexuality. And people know that. There's all these, like, you know, cues that you take from each other. And they're not, you would hope that they are more organic. But they're not. Almost everything we do, if you smoke a cigar, you're sending a message that I'm a cigar smoker. Punk rock outfit, or, you know, even me, I don't dress anyway, which is my way of saying, don't judge me by how I'm dressed, you know, judge me by whatever else that you're putting out. It's a very controlled thing. And so I've been talking about that on stage, like, you know, a guy who drives a sports car and, you know, how much of that is insecurity. Like, they don't, if you see a guy in a sports car, they don't look at you. You're at a red light and you're looking at him because you're going, how did you afford this? Like, who did you screw over to afford a Ferrari? But they don't look at you. They always look straight ahead. Like, they don't need anything that you have to offer. There's nothing to the left or the right. They're straight ahead to their mansion or their hot wife. You're in your Mitsubishi. You're looking all over the place. If you're in a Mitsubishi, you're looking around. There's got to be something better out there than what I got in here. And so yeah, just the whole idea of you know, how little we develop and put out who we really are.
So you would be going over notes like that?
Yeah, I go through the notes and then there's not a lot of prep other than writing. I've always got pages of notes in my pocket and I'm trying to, because I'm at heart a writer. And so stand up to me is a way of trying out the writing. And then before I go on, I just pack it in so I don't run out of new stuff. Because if I go on stage and I don't do any new stuff, I get pretty bored.
Greg Fitzsimmons, podcaster of FitzDog Radio and comedian. He was in Seattle performing, but since that was in the past, now as you're hearing this, you'll have to catch him next time. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to talk gardening. Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, Willie Galloway. Stick around.
This is KUOW 94.9, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Herzl Ner Tamid, presenting Torathon 6, a Jewish Wisdom Symposium, November 7th, 11th, and 14th. Professors and rabbis deliver thought-provoking lectures from the deeply philosophical to the personally fulfilling. All are invited. More information online at h-nt.org.
KUOW brings you results from all the local, statewide, and national races. We'll have full election coverage tonight from 5 to 11.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
52 degrees in Seattle's University District. Some fog still hanging around. That will burn off. We'll get a high of around 58 degrees on this election day, with rain expected this afternoon. Tonight's low around 46, mostly cloudy, showers likely, mainly before 10 o'clock tonight.
And now we garden. Our gardening panel is joining us. Here we are in November, but we still have a few things to discuss before we travel to warmer climes. I don't know what you guys are planning. I'm just hunkering down. Willie Galloway is host of the gardening and cooking website digginfood.com. Her book is Grow, Cook, Eat. She joins us. Hello, Willie. Oh, well, she will join us. Now you're there. Are you there, Willie? Oh, well, Jack, you'll find it. No, I'm not going to do that yet, Jack. I'm going to wait for you when you know for sure. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward and works on habitat restoration. Good to see you again, sir.
Good morning.
You can see him as co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You can find her works at martywingate.com. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Are you gearing up for you're gearing up for next spring?
Yes,
May tours.
We are looking.
Thinking you might
May.
Be talking about winter tours to the gardens of Mexico or
not,
something.
Oh well, that would be nice. No, we have. I just put up the day-to-day itinerary for our May tour, which starts in London. It's the Downton Abbey tour. We're going to Highclere Castle, and we're going to the place that they film Doc Martin, plus we're going to some fabulous gardens. And we already have some people signed up, so I've had lots of email interest, and I think you better think fast.
All right, when you say the Downton Abbey tour, are you going to go to the building?
We're going to Highclere Castle, where they filmed Downton Abbey. We have a tour there. And
they got a nice garden?
They have a lovely castle garden. And we're also going to lots of other film sites. We're going to be in Oxford for a day, so anyone who's a Inspector Morse or Lewis fan could go there. We're going to the garden where they filmed some scenes from Pride and Prejudice in 2005. We're staying in Foy in Cornwall, which is where Daphne du Maurier lived, and where the house that inspired Rebecca.
You're such an Anglophile.
Last night I dreamt I was at Manderley again. Oh! And did you know that Daphne du Maurier wrote The Birds?
I did know that.
Did you read the story?
I did not.
It's creepy.
Well, the movie was creepy enough.
Well, it's creepy
and
in a
Rebecca
way.
Was creepy enough.
And My Cousin Rachel.
Yeah.
Oh.
Hitchcock and du Maurier, they had something in common.
Yeah.
She's an Anglophile.
I am.
You got any plans for any sort of, can you top that travel, Greg Rayburn?
No, I can't. I'm a Northwestophile.
A Northwestophile. All right. If you have some thoughts or questions about your garden in these wettering days, though today's pretty nice, right? It's not bad. These guys are here. Some last-minute plans or maybe some planning you want to do. Our number is 206-543-5869. 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday at kuow.org. Willie Galloway from Portland, are you there?
I am.
Good. I'm sorry. We were pressing different buttons earlier. I apologize. How's the weather?
Lovely. Warm.
Warm?
Yeah. It's supposed to be 64 degrees today.
What?
Wow.
I know.
See, that's I don't think we're getting that warm here.
It was 65 on Sunday.
Yeah, but then it seemed like it was getting colder.
Yeah, it did.
Have you seen anything in your garden that indicates that they care one way or the other about the temperatures right now?
Not really. I'm continuing to enjoy the progression of fall color. Right now, the smoke trees around town are starting to light up, as it were. They turn great shades of orange and red.
Are you?
Oh,
sir?
I'm enjoying the fall color and also moving plants. It's that time of year when it's great for transplanting. I have lots of naturally seeded plants that, you know, trees that are in places that I really wouldn't like them. So it's a great time to be out there moving things around.
Are you?
Yes.
What have you moved?
Well, cedars are, I'm on a septic system, and so I have a mound that, although I wanted it to be a wildflower meadow, things like alders and cedars have had a different opinion.
It's a natural succession,
yeah.
Greg.
Exactly, exactly. So
you don't want them there?
No.
What would they do to your septic field?
They would destroy it in pretty short, or well, short. In, by tree life terms, it would be short order.
Because the roots would go down, move things around?
Yes, on top of a septic system, I planted a lot of things like sword ferns and other ferns and some small shrubs, which work great there because they're shallow rooting, but not something I want to have a huge tree growing out of.
By the way, 6 degrees difference between Portland and Seattle. Hmm. Portland's 6 degrees warmer. But you're still going to get rain later, it says, Willie. What are you doing in your garden?
Well, I need to mow my lawn, which is always like, I feel like in November, you know, you're starting to wind down your garden and then your grass grows and you have to mow it before it kind of chills out there for a few months. So, and our mower broke this summer, but conveniently right about the time the grass went dormant. So I need to get that fixed.
All right. All right. Well, what are you doing in your garden? What questions do you have for Willie Galloway, for Greg Rayburn, for Marty Wingate? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Mike's in Clearview, Mike? Is that where you're at?
Yeah, that's right.
What are you thinking? What's your question?
So I had some cedar hog fuel and other wood chip type products. Put it into my garden, and it grew very poorly. And I know I've kind of had this happen years ago, and I just wonder if there's something I can do to help that compost more quickly or to get the soil back into condition where it can, you know, grow some decent vegetables.
Well, in general, I would avoid woody mulches in vegetable gardens. A good rule of thumb is to put like mulch with like plants. So if you're growing things that are herbaceous plants like perennials, then it's nice to have a compost around them that's decomposed. Whereas like woody trees and shrubs respond really well to having a woody mulch.
No.
So I would recommend...
Is it in there? Is there anything I can do about it?
Well, can you remove the woody mulch from your vegetable garden areas and move it to more where you have trees and shrubs and then replace it with like a compost layer?
Yeah, it's been mixed in with the rototiller and, you know, I put it in the spring, so it's been sitting in there and mixing in and it got hoed in and all that. So it's in the dirt.
So it's in there. Well, adding some compost would probably be a good addition to help bring the soil back to life.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I see.
And I had a comment also. I know it's probably not the exact season, but you guys get a lot of calls about horsetail.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of soil that I got from, I'm a contractor, and I did a job where they had some really nice topsoil, but it had horsetails in it. And when I brought it home, of course, it grew there too. And I was able to get rid of those by repeated applications of just white vinegar during the growing season.
That's great. Was that just bare soil then, or did you have anything else growing there?
It was just the soil. I relocated that soil once I got it to my site, and then I put it in a flat play field kind of area. And it started growing the horsetail, and I just came back with the vinegar and sprayed it, you know, while it was growing, and eventually it just died out.
They don't like it.
Well, yeah. And that's good, you know, if you can keep an eye on soil you think is contaminated with weed seeds, if you can not do anything to it for a while and then keep up with the vinegar, that's mm-hmm. great.
Mike, thanks. Thanks for that. Jenny's in Seattle. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I love your show. I have a question about our raised vegetable beds we have in our backyard. We want to settle them down for the winter. And I'm wondering, we were thinking about chopping up a bunch of leaves and putting them on top. Now I'm kind of rethinking that maybe based on what Greg just said to the previous caller. We have mostly big leaf maple leaves. Is that a good idea to put on a vegetable bed?
What do you think, Willie?
Yeah, so what I would consider doing is not just putting leaves on, but if you could mix them with grass clippings, or if you still have some vegetables in your bed that don't have a disease or pest problem, taking those out. I like to take the leaves. It's best if they fall on your lawn and you can just collect them with your mower in a bag, because the mower will chop up the leaves really small and mix it with grass clippings all at the same time. And so then you pretty much have perfect mulch for a vegetable garden. It's a good idea, regardless, to chop the leaves up with your mower.
Right.
Or if you don't have a mower, you can put them in a clean garbage can and use a weed trimmer, like an immersion blender. You just stick it in there and zap it, and it chops up the leaves. That works really well, too. Just wear safety glasses if you do that. And then you can pile that on your beds, you know, about 18 inches high. And then what I like to do is sprinkle a little bit of compost on top and put burlap over the top, because
we were planning on layering leaves, compost, and then burlap on top. But I wasn't sure whether the leaves would be okay, and whether to put those on first or put the compost on first.
Yeah, you know, and just chopping them up helps them decompose faster. If you don't, especially those big leaf maples, they just kind of form this slimy mat. And so chopping them up gives more surface area for the microorganisms to help break those leaves down by spring. And then in spring, you know, in, let's say, early February, you can take off the burlap and just use a little 3 or 4 tine cultivator to kind of work that into the soil if it's not fully decomposed yet.
Sounds great. So that it doesn't matter whether we put the leaves on and then the compost or vice versa?
No, not really. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ginny. Thanks for calling. Let me turn to Barry in Edmonds. Barry, what are you thinking about?
Yeah. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a couple Brugmansias that used to be exposed completely, and I haul them every year into the garage. But this year we did this large covered deck, and so now they're semi-covered. I'm wondering, can I get away with just composting them and leaving them on the deck, or do I have to lug them into the garage again?
And where do you live?
Edmonds, so we face due west.
Yeah.
It's pretty exposed, but they're now covered by this. It's kind of like an outdoor room kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I think if you can bring the containers up against the house and covered, I would bet that they'll do okay.
Okay. Thanks much.
Thank you. So
Brugmansia
is a... Yeah. It's in the Solanaceae family?
Yeah, I think it is. It has fabulous, fragrant, hanging down flowers. They're big. The shrub can get really large if it gets a good start.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It sure can get large. Where is it from? It's tropical? Or it's South African? Where is it from?
Not from here.
Not from here. Wow. All right. Rob's in Snohomish. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for calling.
So my question today is about compost. We have horses, and so we have a lot of stall cleanings piled up, hundreds and hundreds of yards of it. And it does break down, but it breaks down into a sort of a spongy material. It's not really something you can compact. Mm-hmm. And to use it as a soil augmentation, for instance, where you've got a bare spot in the lawn or something, it isn't really appropriate because it never turns into what I think of as dirt. I'm trying to figure out turn my compost into dirt.
What can you do?
Well, compost... it should have a nice sponginess to it because it is organic matter, rather broken down organic matter. And once you mix it with the soil, then it becomes, you add the other components of the sand and gravels and things, other things that are important for soil. So using it as an amendment rather than as a standalone soil works fine. But it also, the main thing is you want to make sure it's thoroughly composted. Is that'll help really improve its quality. So it shouldn't really resemble horse manure by the time it's done.
I see. What should he do to get the – anything you want to add to that, Willie, about what to do to sort of move it along?
Well, I'm assuming if he's cleaning out stalls that they had bedding in them. And so a wood chip or a straw bedding will help decompose that into a compost better, because the horse manure is going to be really high in nitrogen. And so if it's mixed in with the bedding, which is, you know, typically a dry, more carbon-like material, that helps with the compost, and it helps it compost instead of just age. And yeah, you know, if you pile up into a pile, and if you have a little, some sort of machine to help you turn it, because if you have hundreds of yards of it, that sounds like quite a bit. then yeah, it'll break down into great compost. But you know, compost is just one part of soil. Soil is made up, as Greg said, of mineral particles, and so it's not ever going to turn into soil. It's just going to always be a component of soil.
And go ahead.
Are you familiar with the manure share program by King Conservation District? Do we still have it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I am familiar with the program, but I'm kind of greedy. I want to keep my stuff for myself. I'm just trying to figure out how to turn it into more useful material. And it sounds like what I should be doing is buying or acquiring pretty nutrient limited topsoil or fill and mix them together.
Well, after you have a finished composted, if you add that material when during the composting process, you're going to slow your composting down. Do you have a three-bin system currently? Are you doing one big pile?
I have an enormous pile that we turn with a tractor that has probably the base layer is as old as 20 years old.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so having a more rotational system might help you as well, where you move different batches through and then add the fresh to a new area rather than trying to manage it in one large pile.
You know, you mentioned the consistency of the other materials. So what about wet leaves versus dry leaves? I mean, wet leaves are fine, right, just as long as you balance it with other materials that are drier?
Well, it's going to be hard for them to be not wet at this point.
But
well, and if there's bedding, there should be, you know, at least in my experience, I worked at a ranch in college, and there was a lot of bedding in the stalls mixed in with the manure. And so we would clean the stalls out, and we would clean everything out, including the dry bedding. And so that would be mixed in with the manure, and then it was a good ratio.
I see.
So if that's not the case, then, yeah, adding in leaves or something would be good. And then just using it as a – I guess if he wants to buy topsoil – to make new beds or something, that's fine. But otherwise, he can just use it as a mulch or mix it in with soil, but he doesn't necessarily need to. He has a great resource of compost right there. He basically, he would never need to go to Cedar Grove and buy Cedar Grove compost, which is, you know, so he's got compost, and then he can just use it in all the ways that you can use compost, as a mulch, as a soil amendment by mixing it in, and so but if he does want to, you know, kind of make his own new topsoil, he could buy topsoil and mix it together, you know, probably about 2/3 or 3/4 soil to 1/4 compost.
All right, Kevin, you get the last question here, since we talked about moving things at the beginning. What are you moving?
Well, thanks for calling, or thanks for taking my call. We have a magnolia tree. It's about 10 feet high, 3 or 4 inches in diameter. The previous owner of the house planted it 3 or 4 years ago. It's in our backyard, and I was thinking about moving it to the front between the sidewalk and the road and that strip of grass that's there. Do you have any advice?
I would wait for our magnolia leaves seem to have turned yellow overnight, and they're dropping. I would wait for the leaves to drop. And magnolias aren't that thrilled about being transplanted, but this will be a great time to do it. And you'll just need to be really careful about watching how dry the soil gets. You'll water it next summer and the summer after that during dry periods. And a flowering magnolia, I assume, it may, if it has flowered for you, it may not flower for you next year. It may take a while to settle in.
You may also want to add, depending on how much of the roots you're able to move with that tree, you may want to stake it for the first season, too. And when you stake them, trees, stake them low and loose. But you want, in case there's a windstorm or something, sometimes when you first transplant the trees that are larger, you might end up with some it might tip over. So that might be worth keeping in place, only for the first year until the new roots grow in.
All right. Thank you for your phone calls. And wow, we didn't talk about the campaign at all. Do you want to get anything in? No, I'm joking.
Vote native plants.
Vote native plants. Very nice. Willie Galloway, Greg Rayburn, Marty Wingate, thank you all very much. Talk to you next week.
Thanks.
And we'll talk to you again tomorrow with election updates. And you can listen to KUOW and NPR tonight starting at 5 for all the election returns. And, of course, more to come about China and much more today on KUOW.
The big contest this election year is the presidential race, but control of the U.S. Senate is also at stake. NPR News will be with many senatorial candidates as we learn who will lead the chamber for the next 2 years. I'm Robert Siegel. Join us for results, analysis, and reports from across the country. Special coverage of election night from NPR.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.